Be seated, please. Next case, actually it's three cases combined. It's the lead case of United States versus Ali. I guess we're going to hear first from you, Mr. McCarthy.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court.
Okay.
I'm Joe McCarthy for Mr. Abdirahman Jibril, one of many defendants in this consolidated case. I'll limit my comments to count one briefly, and then I'll surrender the podium to my colleagues who will address other issues. As the Court will recall, count one, the defendants are all charged with a conspiracy to...
Can you just pull that mic up a little bit?
I'm sorry. Good. Right. They're all charged with this conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute cot. As the Court will recall, cathinone is the active ingredient within cot.
Is it cot or cat?
We debate that with among ourselves.
What do the Somalis say?
My client always called it cot.
Okay.
And the conspiracy is to distribute cathinone. They've all used cot, as the Court will recall, and they were open and notoriously about it. The evidence showed that each of these defendants, in one way or another, either was importing, selling, buying, or even chewing cot. The Court instructed the jury that to find the defendants guilty on count one with this conspiracy, they were required to find that the defendants knew that cot actually contained this active ingredient, the Schedule I controlled substance, cathinone, or another controlled substance. Now, the government, whether the Court agrees with our position that the jury actually had to define that the defendants knew that cot contained cathinone, or whether the jury was only required to find that they were aware that cot contained some controlled substance, the evidence in this case failed to meet that burden for the government. The government could prove that either by direct or circumstantial evidence. There was no direct evidence. I don't think the government will make the argument that anybody was shown to know that cot contained this Schedule I controlled substance, cathinone. There was significant circumstantial evidence, however, that the government advanced to show beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendants knew that there was a controlled substance within cot. As it related...
Don't all our cases suggest that's enough?
Indeed. Now, because it's a conspiracy, we advance the argument for the Court's consideration that they were required to find that they knew cathinone was in cot rather than a controlled substance. But I think the point for purposes of this morning is it really doesn't matter, because whether they had the universe of controlled substances or cathinone itself, there was insufficient evidence to satisfy that element in the case. As it related to my client, Mr. Jibril, the government advanced certain pieces of circumstantial evidence from which they argued that he must have known. It's illustrative for the other defendants as well, but on behalf of Mr. Jibril, the government made arguments such as he bought 2 to 4 pieces of cot at a time from Mr. Ishak, who was the leader in this conspiracy, that he discounted the price to my client, and that my client, who was working at a money transaction business called Dahabshil, would help the leader of this conspiracy by sending the money to the Middle East for him. The point is, U.S. versus Kassir, a Second Circuit case, made the observation that these kinds of facts do not lead inexorably to the conclusion that the defendant therefore knows that cot contains a controlled substance. Kassir makes a good point that...
Was Jibril one of the ones, was he part of a telephone conversation with Ishak where they talked about how to avoid detection by the police? Travel alone, don't go somebody else, because then you'll have mixed different stories.
I don't believe it was my client.
Okay, what was Jibril? There was some telephone conversation.
There were telephone conversations between all the defendants and Mr. Ishak, and there were wiretaps that captured all these individuals speaking. And they were all openly and notoriously talking about cot during these conversations. And in some conversations, Mr. Ishak did talk about traveling as he would come down the interstate and when the police would stop him, and that's true. And I'm out of my time already, but the point is simply, if the Court would indulge me for a minute, the dilemma I think the government has is the way cot is handled versus marijuana. Virtually every controlled substance is a distilled product. Cocaine comes from coca leaves, heroin comes from opium. Marijuana and cot are real exceptions in that they are the mediums through which the active ingredient is delivered. In marijuana's case, THC is delivered to the user. In cot's case, cathinone. The way the statute, though, handles marijuana in contrast with cot is informative. The prosecution in a marijuana case need only prove that the defendant possessed or knew he was trafficking in marijuana, because marijuana itself is in the statute as a prohibited entity or item. COT's different. COT's not a prohibited material the way marijuana is a prohibited material. And that's the dilemma that the government has in this case. We can all possess COT as long as it doesn't contain those active ingredients. And unlike marijuana, where the government can simply get away with and rest its case on showing that the defendant asked to buy marijuana, the government can't do that.
What's the language of the statute? Substance or mixture that contains cathinone?
A Schedule I controlled substance, yeah. Yes. But there is that statute for marijuana, and we were wrestling with how this is different from virtually every other case. In the schedules, they're all distilled products. COT's not the distilled product. Marijuana is not the distilled product. But marijuana is dealt with, and COT's not.
Can COT exist without the active prohibited ingredient?
Yes. What the record would show the court is, when it's picked freshly, it contains cathinone, a Schedule I controlled substance. As it degrades and becomes stale, that cathinone converts, and the government endorses this as well, that cathinone converts to a Schedule IV controlled substance, cathinone. Cathine. Cathinone to cathine, thank you. So it goes from...
Which would not be Schedule I prohibited.
It's not a Schedule I controlled substance. And I don't know the answer to how long the cathine will stay in the dried out cot before that also degrades.
Very important to get it fresh.
Well, and that's certainly something the government emphasized during the trial.
The participants talked about it too.
And
Ishak was very proud of how fresh his stuff was.
He was. We all like fresh coffee too, though, which has a stimulant effect.
I understand. And coffee gives you a high too. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Next, I guess, is Mr. Walsh.
Morning, Your Honor. Thomas Walsh. May it please the court. I represent Khaled Issa, and I, along with other counsels, like to address the phenylpropanolamine, or PPA for easiest way to say it. And that also gives you a high, like cathine or cathinone, and also the PPA. But the PPA is not a controlled substance.
I understood from the record, though, that the PPA did not degrade, force of giving a high was constant, whereas cathinone would degrade over time, so that when the conspirators talked about the importance of having COT fresh, they had to be addressing the cathinone aspect, not the PPA.
And maybe you were able to determine that based on my leading questions, because I wasn't allowed, my counsel were not allowed to have an expert. The court abused its discretion in allowing us to have an expert. We would probably have listed that.
Well, testimony. The question is it relevant if that's true?
Well, I think as I looked through the transcript and listened to the testimony, not one person ever mentioned cathinone. These gentlemen did not know what cathinone is. They knew that they chewed this legally in their country, and then when they got here, they chewed it. Although it wasn't allowed to come in for immigration, agricultural reasons, as we heard, but they would get a buzz off it. And PPA is one, it's a stimulant. It is a substance that is not controlled, and that could give you the same high. The government, well, the court abused its discretion by denying us the ability to have this expert testify to that.
Well, wouldn't that make everything pretty confusing?
I think it would go right to the essence of the issue.
Except that the evidence, undisputed evidence, I think, was that cathinone degrades into cathine.
I agree with the court.
And that the high from cathinone is lost when the COT gets stale or older, whereas PPA doesn't. So they're clearly focusing their distribution efforts into preserving the cathinone, the high from the cathinone, because it's present when the COT is fresh.
Well, I agree with the court, but we don't know what high PPA does. We don't know. The PPA may be an even stronger high than
cathinone. It's not a question whether it's a strong high. I mean, coffee gives you a high, too.
That's correct.
It's a question of whether it's a different characteristic that would confuse the symptoms of cathinone.
I don't agree with the court, because the government couldn't say cathinone.
Well, let me ask you, does the record provide evidence that the PPA does not degrade? It's constant high, the same level over time.
I don't know if the record addresses either of that. I was unable to present that.
There's no evidence in the record you say about that?
I don't believe.
I thought that was the basis for the court's ruling.
No, the court's ruling was that it wasn't relevant. I don't know why it's not relevant. I can't see it's not relevant.
I thought it was because of what I just mentioned to you.
Right, that it doesn't degrade. And
yes.
I don't believe there was any testimony that it didn't degrade. Only I think the court was realized that what degraded was cathinone. I don't think there was evidence that PPA never degraded. What happened was is that the government had an expert witness lined up. They began to present the case, and the only way they could get Scienter was through establishing that the cot was fresh, that it was there's a preservation factor, that it was shipped, and that there was a question called Giza. However, what happened was is as we came to the eve of trial, even though there was a discovery motion, 7 days and 3 days before trial, the government moved to change its lab reports. And lo and behold, the PPA was off the lab report. We gave notice to the government 5 days out, which is, I would submit, was good cause, concerning an expert that we had, because as we started to.
I think your light's off.
All right. I'll end that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, sure.
Good morning. May it please the court. William Cummings. I represent Najee Al-Ishmawi. Mr. Al-Ishmawi appeals from the denial of his Rule 29 motions for insufficiency of evidence. Mr. Al-Ishmawi, like many of these people, were primarily users. There was some distribution, but these were not street dealers in the sense of distribution. They were using the cot because they enjoyed using it, and they found a source of supply through Mr. Ishak. Now, the government has the burden of proving that my client and all the others had the requisite knowledge, the scienter, in order to make this scheme of outlawing cathinone but not cot to make it viable. And they tried to do that with regard to my client through inferences. There was no direct evidence that he had any knowledge of the fact that cot contained a controlled substance. Likewise, there was no direct evidence that he knew it was illegal. Of course, we know that it can be illegal for reasons other than that it contains a controlled substance. And the government suggests four primary points that they think that the jury could use to infer this knowledge. One were the many telephone calls, or several telephone calls, he had with Mr. Ishak, the leader of the conspiracy. In the 11 calls that they so-called cherry-picked to use, there were many more beside that, the ones they introduced into evidence, there's never any conversation that suggests that Mr. Ishak is conveying such information to Mr. Al-Ishmawi. First of all, Mr. Ishak testified that although he learned in 2005 that cot was illegal, the importation of cot was illegal, he did not learn that it contained a controlled substance until the spring of 2011 when he was arrested in this case and put in jail. That's the first time he knew it contained a controlled substance. And the other thing that they suggest is that somehow because Mr. Al-Ishmawi had a brother who also ran a store and was a customer of Mr. Ishak, that somehow, if that brother had knowledge that cathinone or that cot contained a controlled substance, somehow the jury can infer that he would have communicated that to my client. Again, no evidence, no palpable, no tangible evidence, no phone calls, nothing to support that kind of an inference. We're talking about inferences upon inferences, which are not sufficient. Then they suggest that because my client asked to have Mr. Ishak send some cot to his friends in Alabama, that somehow there's a problem there. At one point, the judge was told by the government that Mr. Ishak knew or testified that some of those shipments were seized. We pointed out that there was no such testimony whatsoever from Mr. Ishak about that. In fact, Mr. Ishak, when he was telling Mr. Hersey, his friend, his supplier in England, to ship some to Alabama, he told him, don't worry, there won't be any seized. There are no foreigners down there living in Alabama. In other words, no reason why packages coming from England would be suspicious, I suppose. That's Mr. Ishak talking. No indication that Mr. Ishak ever shared any of this information about the packages and how they arrived or didn't arrive with Mr. Alish Mali. There's no phone calls. And the important thing is that the government wants to suggest the jury can infer this communication between the two, but Mr. Ishak was their witness. He was on the stand for 3 days. If he had had any such communication about these points with Mr. Alish Mali, all they had to do was ask him, and they never did. And then they come to the end of the case and says, you, the jury, can infer, and the judge allowed that. That was our point at the Rule 29. How can you allow that when they had their witness on the stand? He could have said, I told him about that, I described my experience with its illegality, and he never asked a question. And then the last thing they have is to suggest that my client somehow would have discerned this point of illegality or controlled substance somehow because the packages, some packages were mislabeled. The government introduced 9 packages into evidence out of 1,500 packages. We derived that by the gross amount that their agent said that the cop was. And their first witness, Mr. Garn, postal inspector, says, well, shippers frequently mislabeled, not always. So we don't have any basis for which the jury could discern that the packages that Mr. Alish Mali received, 2 at his store, 1 or 2, and 1 at the UPS store, which the government never introduced, somehow were mislabeled, or that Mr. Alish Mali, again, somehow should have discerned if they were, again, they have to infer that they were, that they somehow he would have gleaned some from that this was improper or illegal. But the important thing was controlled substance, because illegality by itself under the Kassir case, which is a Sixth Circuit case, that's not enough, because a product, particularly an agricultural product, can be illegal to bring in the United States for all sorts of reasons, either for health reasons or for contamination reasons or any number of reasons. So the fact that it's illegal to import has nothing to do with whether or not it contains a controlled substance. I realize that my time is getting close to the end. But there is just no evidence whatsoever, no substantive facts from which a jury could infer that Mr. Alish Mali had the knowledge.
What page were the telephone calls on? What part of the appendix? Do you happen to know that offhand?
Well, they're in the government exhibit 30 series.
You don't know what reference is in the JA?
I can tell you in just a second, Your Honor. I can tell you.
I have read those, and I just
they were in in the 4,400 pages.
4,400. Okay, thank you.
It was the 4,547 and 4,8 when he tells Mr. Hersey to send 5 pieces to Alabama. In his testimony, he said that his first shipment to Alabama contained 40 pieces. No way. That's from his testimony. His actual communication to Mr. Hersey is send 5 pieces. That's 4,547. And a few days later, he calls him back and says, did you send them? How many did you send? And he says, basically, I haven't sent them yet. And so Ishak tells him, we'll send them tomorrow. And that's when he tells him, don't worry about it. There are no foreigners that live down there. But no communication, either in the telephone conversation with Mr. Alish Mali or a question by the government to the witness, was there ever any communication about between Mr. Alish Mali and Mr. Ishak. Thereafter, after Mr. Alish Mali says, would you send some cot to my friends with regard to the Alabama shipments whatsoever? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Mr. Frank?
Good morning. May it please the court, Michael Frank on behalf of the United States. I'll first address Mr. Alish Mali since he was the most recent person discussed here. There was more than sufficient evidence to show that Mr. Alish Mali had the requisite knowledge here or, frankly, deliberate indifference with respect to whether the cot contained cathinone, a controlled substance. So, for example, there was evidence that Mr. Alish Mali had received packages of cot at his stores and possibly at his house, at least 2 packages. The evidence showed that the packages that were seized were all mislabeled. Each one of them had been labeled as children's toys, picture frames, clothes. certainly not Cott. The jury also heard from approximately 10 U.S. Customs and Border Protection inspectors who work at the JFK mail facility, where all of the mail coming in from Europe first arrives, that if somebody had labeled a package Cott, it would have been seized. In fact, they go to some measures to try to intercept Cott. They're not 100% successful, but they do x-ray packages, et cetera, and try to disrupt Cott. So Mr. Alashmali had received at least two packages. He then asks Mr. Ishak to send some packages down to friends in Alabama. He is, at some point from the telephone calls, you can determine that he was down in Alabama also, and that some of these packages were intercepted, or they never made it to Alabama, I should say. The defense argues you can't, the jury couldn't infer that Customs and Border Protection intercepted these. But it was certainly Mr. Ishak's view that they had been intercepted. That became a bad address, and he just stopped sending cot there because it wasn't worth it. He had to pay the shippers for the cot, but it wasn't getting through. The jury certainly could have inferred from all of that that Mr. Alashmali could figure out that there is something nefarious, something illegal going on here. There was also the fact that he was a cot user. Every single one of the defendants was a cot user. There were various telephone calls where various defendants talk about getting high on cot, predicting whether the cot will be very fresh and how high they'll get that night. Mr. Cummings pointed out also that Mr. Alashmali is the brother of Mr. El-Bukhady, another one of the defendants. They both ran stores up in the Brooklyn area, Queens and Brooklyn, I should say. Mr. Ishak used to stay with Mr. El-Bukhady when he'd come up there to get the cot. They would chew cot together. They were very close. Mr. El-Bukhady
also... What does chewing cot prove in terms of knowledge of cathinone?
It shows that they know that it's a substance that induces a high, and that itself would give them some sense that this might be something that is unlawful.
Well, you agree that you can get high on something that's not a prohibited Schedule I?
You can... you certainly can, or one of the other schedules for that matter, too.
Exactly.
I would say it's not extremely common. I certainly think it would put somebody, give somebody some indicia to think that, hey, there might be something nefarious about this. The other thing.
It's not a strict liability.
No, it's certainly not, Your Honor.
Then you have, so the circumstantial evidence is that clearly you could infer that they knew it was something that may be prohibited.
That is one inference that could be drawn, and in light of all the other evidence.
Now, don't you have to skip to another inference then that substance is in what's prohibited? That's inference on top of inference, isn't it?
Well, no, you don't have to. If they're getting high after chewing cot, they have knowledge that something in cot gets them high. So I don't think they have to draw any inference there that far. They then would have to suspect or draw an inference that there might be something in that cot that is making them high, that is unlawful. And if all we had were the fact that these defendants were cot chewers, I suspect that would not be sufficient to meet the burden. But there was a lot of other evidence with respect to that, other circumstantial evidence. For example, the fact that the packages were mislabeled, the fact that they used various addresses to receive these packages. So, for example, Mr. El-Bukhady, Mr. Alashmali's brother, and Mr. Ishak were on the telephone. Ishak's telling him, hey, I need other addresses to send these. Mr. Ishak explained at a certain point he didn't keep using the same addresses, at least not during a short period of time, because he didn't want to draw attention to what he was doing. He didn't want one of the people from, for example, a UPS store turning him into the police. He didn't want Customs getting a fix on one of the addresses. And, in fact, that's one of the ways this case came about was Homeland Security agent saw that packages kept going to one address in Virginia and did a controlled delivery to that address, and that's how they discovered who Mr. Ishak was. Before that, they had no idea who he was or his involvement in this. So Mr. Ishak was correct that it was a wise thing to use different addresses. And certainly the defendants, such as Naji Alashmali, Mr. El-Bukhady, and others, helped him to do that. There was also the fact that when Mr. Ishak would deal with them, he didn't deal with them. They all own stores up there. He didn't come in and bring his Coca-Cola truck like Coca-Cola does or General Mills or any of the other corporations that I'm sure sell legitimate products. He would distribute cot out of the trunk of his car, out of garbage bags, and made certain efforts to make sure nobody would see this. So again, another ability for the defendants to see, hey, there might be something amiss about this. All of the defense attorneys also conceded that Cot is a way of life, a culture in Yemen and Somalia, where all of the defendants came from. Just 2 months ago, the Seventh Circuit issued the Myri decision, which is a Cot case. And we didn't cite it, of course, because our briefs were due before then. But in there, Judge Bauer, writing for the panel, notes a study that said 75% of Somali men consume Cot. It also stood to reason, and the jury certainly could infer this, that if Cot is such an important part of your culture and you're going to make money from it being a Cot dealer, that you'll learn about whether it contains unlawful substances or is unlawful in the United States. The jury also heard that a number of the defendants were longtime residents of the United States. So for example, Mr. Abukrugaray had been here for 30 years. I think Khaled Issa had been here 28 or 29 years. So again, they might have a better shot at ignorance if they had just arrived here a few months before they were arrested. But that was certainly not the case with respect to the defendants. The jury also heard about the price differential. Mr. Garn, a postal inspector who has dealt with a number of Cot cases, testified as an expert. He testified that where Cot is legal, for example, previously in the United Kingdom it was legal, you could get a bundle of Cot for $2 to $3. And there was some talk about this in the calls, too, about how cheap it is to get Cot elsewhere. In the United States, in contrast, degraded Cot you can get for perhaps $40 a bundle. The high-end Giza, which contains a lot of cathinone, that costs $90, sometimes over $100. So from this also, the defendant certainly could figure out, why is it so expensive here in the United States? You can factor in even transportation costs. There's no reason why it should be that high other than the fact that it's an unlawful substance and that it's not readily available except through unlawful means. There was also a number of suspicious incidents that happened. There was discussions with Mr. Al-Bukhati, for example, on the phone, where he told Ishak, I was going to pick up one of the packages of Cot in New Jersey, and I was stopped by the police, and I told the police that I was there just to visit a friend. Again, if there's nothing nefarious about Cot, why not just tell the police I'm here to get a shipment of Cot?
Well, how long has this been a restricted substance, cathinone?
I believe since the 90s.
The 90s, right? And Congress did that, right?
They delegated the responsibility as to how to schedule them to the DEA.
Exactly. And why can Congress just make it, since this is an agricultural product, just deal with it like marijuana, the plant itself illegal?
And Judge Bauer made that exact point for the Seventh Circuit, and I saw that he indicated others have said that also. I don't presume to speak for Congress. You're right. It would be a lot easier.
So we can't write a better law, but we have to adjudicate the law we have. So the question is, it becomes more problematic for you in these criminal prosecutions. You agree, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It'd be much easier for us if they just...
Because everything you've said basically is this clear evidence that they knew it was prohibited. They knew that it made them feel good, and they knew that the quicker they got their product to somebody, the better it made them feel. But none of that really goes to knowledge of what the active chemical ingredient was.
Well, I didn't finish with all that. I mean, I was just getting started.
But that's what, answer my question as you finish.
I'm not sure I understand your question. There was other evidence. So, for example, an elderly Somali woman stated that testified that Sawada Ali, another one of the defendants, specifically told her that Cot was illegal in the United States. So that indicates to me that they certainly knew something about Cot was illegal. Another one of the defendants...
It's illegal to import pineapples into Hawaii. You can't bring pineapples into Hawaii. That's illegal. Because they don't want to destroy their bread and butter plant, right? But it doesn't mean that there's something in the pineapple that's an active ingredient in Schedule 1.
No.
And I'll be just as secretive about my pineapples going into Hawaii, too. Hey, I'm pushing pineapples in Hawaii. Be careful. Right? You do the same thing that's consistent with secretiveness, price differentials. The more the risk involved, the more the price goes up. That doesn't mean that the ingredient is there. It means it's risk and price.
Well,
it's market-driven things, not substance, necessarily.
I think you take precaution in relation to the risk you are facing. And so, for example, you might take some precautions if you're going to import pineapples to Hawaii, but I don't know that you're going to go to the great efforts that these defendants did, because what happens if you import pineapples to Hawaii in your luggage? They seize them.
But if you intended to conceal it.
I'm sorry?
If you intended to conceal your import of pineapples, that would be evidence to suggest you knew it was illegal.
Correct, Your Honor.
But illegality doesn't get you there, necessarily, does it?
Well, I think you're correct that there are...
For example, you know it's illegal to bring in tobacco products. Let's say in Somalia, the tobacco there was real strong, was really good, but you can't import it without paying the tax and duty, but that doesn't mean that something in that tobacco has an ingredient. It's not illegality. Yes, that is illegal in terms of importation, but it's more than illegality. I think Judge Niemeyer asked the question. It's the content knowledge, not just that it's illegal. Isn't that correct?
No, as this court and every other court that has addressed the issue has stated, the government simply had to show that they knew there was some controlled substance in the cot.
That's what I just said. Maybe I'm missing something. Not just that it's illegal to import the substance, but that it has knowledge that something, cathinone, is in it, correct?
Correct. That's what the court instructed, and we argue correctly instructed the jury on this. And, you know, your argument, you know,
you
that you...
say they have to know there's cathinone in it?
No.
I think they just need to know it's illegal.
Correct. And every court
controlled.
Of appeals...
That's that what controlled means.
Correct.
That's illegal to possess it, deal with it, import it, sell it?
Correct. And every court of appeals that has addressed this issue, including Myrie, the Seventh Circuit
virtually
decision...
Virtually unanimous, isn't it?
Correct, Your Honor. It is unanimous. I'm not aware of any court of appeals holding otherwise. Judge Gregory, the defendants made that exact argument to the jury, and the jury, I submit, could have inferred that if they had so chosen to. They heard all of the evidence, and taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, I think that it is sufficient evidence here to support the verdict.
There was some evidence in the record that one of the co-conspirators knew it contained an illegal substance. So if it's a conspiracy, why can't that be imputed to every member of the conspiracy?
Yes, I think that's a point we made, and perhaps not the best in our briefs, but Mr. Ishak certainly knew that. Swato Ali certainly knew that. Ishmael Abdi, another one of the co-conspirators, admitted to federal agents. He knew it was unlawful. Another co-conspirator, Ahmed Hassan, was interviewed by agents. He made false exculpatory statements saying he didn't know anything about cot, didn't know anything about Ishak, then changed those stories and admitted, yeah, I guess I did get some cot from him every once in a while. So yes, there was certainly evidence that some of the co-conspirators had actual knowledge. Abukur Garay, for example, had been convicted in Connecticut of cathinone distribution. So again, indicating that he certainly knew that cathinone was an unlawful substance. And there was certainly plenty of evidence that the co-conspirators were constantly talking to each other. Mr. Ishak, so testified that he would talk on almost a daily basis with almost all of his co-conspirators. And I think it was, be almost a fiction. I heard the defense attorney saying, well, none of the calls does Mr. Ishak specifically tell them it's a Schedule I controlled substance or that it's unlawful. Of course he didn't, because they already knew that. Because there are men from Somalia and Yemen who like to consume cot, like to sell cot, and therefore they would learn about
it. So their nationality all just made them elite, made them guilty, didn't it?
No, not at all, Your Honor.
Well, that's pretty close. That's what you just said.
No, certainly... compared to, for example, someone from Canada or Mexico where cot use is not particularly prevalent, they would be more likely to know about it than others. If what the Seventh Circuit said in their decision that 75% of Somali men use cot, they'd be more likely to know about it than somebody who had never heard of cot. And I think a large number of groups probably have never heard of cot. It appears
to be a dangerous slope we go into there to make that kind of leap in terms of what you're supposed to be, your knowledge based on where you live. You could make that argument the further extension as well, based on your demographics and where you come from and neighborhoods that you live in, you ought to know a whole lot more about than somebody come from a suburban area, couldn't you?
Well,
it's a dangerous thing.
Judge Bauer, writing for the Seventh Circuit, indicated in, I think, the opening line, saying, we were indicated they were somewhat unfamiliar with cot. I think it's their decision where they have some discussion about how it's pronounced, and there is some question as to how it's pronounced. I've heard it pronounced as cot. I've heard it pronounced cat, chot, any number of ways. So I think people who have some familiarity with cot, who come from groups who are more likely to have familiarity with it, would certainly be able to answer more questions about it than other people who are unfamiliar with it. So for example, you go to some biker groups, they're certainly much more likely to know about methamphetamine than some other drugs. There's no doubt that certain drugs are more prevalent in certain cultures. I think various courts have mentioned that. So I don't mean any insult to people from Somalia or Yemen. I'm merely restating what the Seventh Circuit said in their opinion. So I believe that there was more than sufficient evidence for the jury to find, again, taking the evidence of light most favorable to the verdict, that the government had proved the mens rea requirement. With respect to the PPA, the government gave, with a PPA expert, the government gave notice with respect to the experts it was going to call approximately 7 months before trial. Again, that's partially because the trial date had moved. 3 weeks into trial, that's when the defense attorneys said that they wanted to call this expert. And Judge Ellis did not abuse his discretion in saying that, one, that it was irrelevant, and two, that he would not find good cause with respect to permitting this expert to testify. There would have been prejudice to the government. We had already called off our pharmacological expert. We had given notice about a pharmacological expert. But by March 29th, I think, at the last status conference, we had told defense counsel that we didn't intend to call him in our case in chief, only possibly in rebuttal. And it would have caused prejudice to the government to try to get him to even see if he knew about PPA. And furthermore, we also made a harmless error argument with respect to that. And if you look at page 48 of the government's brief in the Swadawali case, we cite we quote one of the defense attorney's closing arguments where he specifically says, PPA is not illegal, it is not caught, it is not illegal, it's a stimulant. They were able to get out from one of the chemists that the government had testified that it was a stimulant. And you know, they were certainly able to argue that their clients were seeking caught for the PPA and not for the cathinone, et cetera. I see that I have less than 2 minutes left. If the court does not have any questions for me, I would see.
All right. Thanks, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll hear from Mr. McCarthy again. I guess same order.
And very quickly, Your Honor, Judge Niemeyer, you made the observation that even if they didn't think it was cathinone, if they thought it was illegal, that would be enough.
Controlled substance.
Okay. Yeah. Because the government relies on these furtive gestures to extrapolate from that knowledge about a violation of 21 U.S. Code 841. And, Your Honor, as you pointed out, pineapples is a good example. Cuban cigars, fruit coming in.
Yeah, but they'd be convicted.
Well, they
in
would
In other
be.
Words, if somebody is, it's illegal to import pineapples, yeah. I don't know if it is, but if it is illegal to import pineapples and somebody's concealing it and you see palpable acts of concealment.
Correct.
You could prove scienter that that guy knew it was illegal to import pineapples.
Exactly.
Here it's illegal to possess, sell, and a cot or a cathinone, and if these guys act in a way that's concealing it and hiding it, and that evidence is that they know it is a controlled substance. It's illegal.
Well, and I think that's where the logic breaks down. That is, simply because they know something's wrong.
Not something wrong, it's illegal.
Well, simply because they know something's illegal.
But cot is illegal.
Simply that they know cot is illegal. I'll even go there with you. But what I'd suggest to the court is that doesn't take you, as Judge Gregory, you pointed out, that doesn't take you across the chasm to know that cot is illegal because it violates Section 841.
You don't need to know that. None of the cases hold that. All you need to know is that it's a controlled substance.
Well, that is 841.
Controlled means illegal.
Well, that's what I mean. It's another way of stating they know it's a controlled substance, yeah. 841 violation, as opposed to violating as kassir. U.S. versus Kassir points out, these facts could equally support a suspicion or even a firm conclusion in the mind of a defendant.
That's a good argument. In other words, their conduct may be consistent with something else, but the government is putting together a series of facts of hiding this distribution, importation and distribution, and disguising it, avoiding police. Several of the people know explicitly it's illegal. One was convicted of it. And so the question is, you have a few of the conspirators here where the evidence is quite circumstantial, but we have to examine those to see whether there was enough for the jury to conclude that as a member of the conspiracy, they're imputed with the illegality.
I'd only want to leave the court with the thought that simply because there is perhaps a firm conviction in the mind of a defendant that there's something wrong about my use of cot, either because my fellow Somali
member... something wrong, something illegal.
Even illegal. The government has to prove that the evidence shows beyond any reasonable doubt that not only did they know it was illegal, but they knew it violated this drug statute. And the simple point is...
I don't think there's a case that says that.
Well,
these people are not imputed as being lawyers. Illegality means that it violates a statute. And whether it violates this statute, Section 1, Section 2, Section 3, they're imputed with illegality, with scienter, with the fact that it's a controlled substance.
If they had no idea that cot contained a controlled substance, but they knew it violated the customs law, the court wouldn't conclude that these convictions
stand. Then they
would
be charged with violating the customs laws if they acted in a manner which they indicated that they knew that illegality.
Right.
But I think the evidence in this case, you have a pretty tight-knit group here talking regularly, hundreds of times with each other. Explicitly, a majority of them know it's illegal, and implicitly, the others are being told about how to avoid being caught and how to label things, how to talk to police, how to travel.
I'd only want to leave.
But each one does have to be looked at individually in the case, and people like Alish Mali and Salhan and Samantar.
Jibril.
And Jubrail. I mean, some of these people, the evidence is much thinner than with respect to others. It's no question. I think we will carefully look at each one, recognizing your argument.
We know the court will.
Yeah. All
Thank
right.
You.
Mr. Walsh?
I'd like to comment on Mr. Frank's comment concerning citing to the brief about counsel is able to argue the stimulant and the of PPA. That is argument, and the court instructs a jury that that's not evidence. Which goes right back to the expert that should have been allowed, and there's abuse of discretion by the court. That the PPA is in cot. It is a stimulant. Cot may be.
Is that in the record?
It's in an argument, and I believe it is in record.
I thought you should have said that argument was stricken.
It was in argument in closing, but I believe on a leading question by myself before the government and counsel objected that this person's not a pharmacist, or
was it sustained?
I believe I got the answer at one time, and then it was sustained after that.
Well, it seems to me you either have it one way or the other.
and so what I'm going to say to the court is this: is we know that the customs people said that cot is not legal to come in because it is an agricultural issue, but PPA. It gives you a high, and the government wanted to show that chewing cot, because they chew cot, inference may be something prohibited because they chewed it and got high. They got high from PPA. And that goes right to the essence of this. The case, the government has a burden. The defendants are presumed innocent. They have a right to put on defense, and that was the expert. The government says they gave us expert notice months beforehand. They did. Then magically, these lab sheets were changed.
So
five
you think
days.
The conspirator who had been previously convicted of cot has no scienter because he thought it was PPA?
He knew he got high. He wasn't sure he got high.
I'm saying he got convicted. He knew he had been convicted of possessing cot
in
Connecticut.
That's correct.
And so the question is, is he entitled to say, I thought it was cot? I mean, PPA?
I don't know if he has to say it's PPA because it burns on him, but I think the government has to show that he knew it was a controlled substance. He may have been convicted because it was an agricultural issue. I don't know. I don't know the issue.
Well,
of that.
He knows.
He knows, but
and
they
acknowledged
have to prove
he was convicted for cot.
Correct, and they have to prove it. It could have been because he had something that shouldn't have come into the United States, and they didn't prove that on Mr. Guerra, I believe it is. However, the PPA. I have to address this because the government says we had 7 months' notice, but what happens is all of a sudden the lab sheets change 5 days before trial and 3 days before trial, and the PPA is gone. It's dropped down below. And then so we gave notice. The government told
the court on the 27th of November, 27th of March or 29th of March that they had an expert that was going to be, could be used for rebuttal. It was the expert they designated. It was a pharmacologist, and they could testify to that. We gave notice in the third week of trial, the same time they called it. If we look at their brief, and I don't have the page, they called that gentleman off the third week. He could have easily come in and rebutted. The government held out that he was a rebuttal witness. It was a good cause, and the probative value exceeds the prejudice to the government. The government had a witness lined up, gave notice, discussed it, and had it on call. It easily could have brought in there. So our experts should have testified. It was abuse of discretion by the district court, and asked the court to reverse that.
Please. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Mr. Cummings? You got one more minute than the others did on rebuttal.
I had 7 3. Yeah.
No, 3 minutes on rebuttal. They got two.
Thank you. First of all, Your Honor, Frank suggested that there might have been some cot delivered to Mr. Alishmali's home. There was never any cot delivered to his house. One or possibly two delivered to a store, and one he picked up at the UPS station. The issue here is I can't assume that these packages were mislabeled. The government says many of them were, most of them were, but Mr. Garn says they are frequently mislabeled. So I think we have to go with that evidence that these are not always guaranteed. But the point is that there's no information that Mr. Alishmali saw or took notice of the fact that what he picked up had a different label on him. And there's never any discussion between him and Mr. Ishak about how they're being concealed, or if they are being concealed, the contents being concealed. There's no such discussion. Mr. Alishmali, bear in mind, is on the end receiver. He's the guy receiving it for his own consumption. And the suggestion that
didn't he do some redistribution or resale? I thought he could make some money.
Among his friends, the colleagues, the co-defendants that were from the Brooklyn area, they did share. Sometimes it would come to Mr. Alishmali and he would pass it on. Sometimes they would buy from him what he had. That's right.
Correct. He was a dealer.
I don't dispute that he was a dealer in that sense. What I'm trying to distinguish it from is a street dealer, someone who's trying to make money out of it as a business. There was some of that going on, no question about it. But in terms of the imputing knowledge that people from Mr. Ishak's group, his overall group, he had a group in the Washington, D.C., Virginia area, he had a group over in Ohio, and he had the group in Brooklyn. Those are three separate and distinct groups, all linked together by Mr. Ishak, no question about it. But in order to get information about what Mr. Ishak may have told to the people in Ohio, they never talked to the people in New York, or the people in New York never talked to the people in the Washington, D.C. area. Never. They didn't know each other. Had no connection whatsoever. The four in New York were Yemenis, and they didn't have any relationship with the Somalis that were in Washington or in Ohio. So the only
was Mr. Ishak a Yemeni, or
he's
was Somali. He
Somali? Somali. What they shared was the cultural heritage with regard to Kat. The Kassir case, Sean, is very, very illustrative, I think, about how they break down this issue about illegality versus controlled substance. Because if I can quote from it, it says, although actual, on page 24 of our opening brief, although actual knowledge that a substance is controlled might in some cases be inferred from the physical effects caused by the substance. In this case, the stimulant effect of Kat is too mild to permit a reasonable inference that Kassir knew that Kat contained a controlled substance. So the fact that they had been chewing this in their early days when they lived in their home country, that effect did not necessarily tell them this is a drug. They didn't use it in Somalia or Yemen as a drug. They used it as we use coffee. It was a social event. They had it at weddings.
A pirates case recently, and the pirates on the Somali, the Somali pirates constantly took breaks to chew cot. So it just confirms what you're saying. They over there, they all chewed cot.
They do, but they chew it there as we drink coffee. Now, my client explains to me
the
difference.
The question is, yeah. I think in this case, the question is, it's illegal in the United States, and whether this group in the United States is importing it and trying to continue to have it new is illegal, a controlled substance in the United States. And that's a circumstantial case with respect to some of the defendants.
The case of my client, Your Honor, the information he could have had.
Your client?
Alice Smalley, Your Honor.
Alice Smalley.
Alice Smalley.
Right.
What information he might have had from Mr. Ishak is about its illegal status or what Mr. Ishak was doing to conceal it. All those things could have been conveyed to him by Mr. Ishak. It could have showed up in the phone calls. It did not. The government could have said to Mr. Ishak, did you ever talk to Mr. Alice Smalley about how you concealed it, about how the package was mislabeled? Did he know that? Did you ever discuss it with him? Did you ever discuss the fact that you knew it was illegal because you heard that in 2005? Did you ever ask him that question? They never asked the question. Now they want the jury to infer that was communicated.
We agree that we'd have to review the record and see what's in the record.
That's where the weakness is.
And with respect to each person, including Mr. Alishman.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. I note that Mr. Cummings, you and Mr. Walsh and Mr. McCarthy are all court-appointed, and I suppose others in the courtroom are. And I want to recognize that service to the court. It's as you know, it's a very important service that we value. And it was a complex, big case, and we'll give it the attention that I hope it deserves. And review these things. We'll come down and greet counsel, but first adjourn court for the day.